This is the Motion Martial Arts Podcast. In this episode, we discuss the topic of focusing on what our instructors can do to us versus what they can do for us. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody. We're back.
Yeah, today we're going to talk about a concept that has come up a few times in conversations I've had. I've seen some people bring it up in different, I guess, articles and conversations, which is an idea of what can my instructor do to me versus what can my instructor do for me. Mm-hmm. And big picture, I think it's kind of an interesting way of saying, should I value my instructor if he can't destroy me in a sparring / fight setting? Should I only value an instructor who can do that to me? And if my instructor can't do that to me, can he still bring value to me?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, definitely one that's come up a couple of times in previous episodes. And it's an interesting topic to really get into, because I know you and I are on the same page that, you know, that teaching is its own skill.
Yeah.
Is a central idea here. And, you know, just because you're really good at jiu-jitsu or you're really good at karate or kickboxing or MMA or any of the martial arts you might practice doesn't mean that you have the ability to make others really good at it too.
Yeah.
And that's the skill of teaching. Now, I will say that I think that I don't think you have to, you know, be able to do, you know, whatever art you practice. I don't think you have to be a high level practitioner to be a good teacher. But I think that most good teachers are, you know, like most good teachers, you know, they were pretty good practitioners in their own right. But then they also just put in the time to learn to be a teacher. And I think that a couple of things that happen is people just, first of all, assume that because they're good at something that they can teach it like that, that it's something that you got to put years of work into learning how to teach. And like you're saying too, that people will assume that because you're this, you know, kind of like decorated competitor or something like that, you're a super accomplished martial artist, that you automatically are the person to go to as a teacher, that you're going to be better than, you know, other teachers because, you know, you're this champion or something like that, which is just not, it's just not true. You know, I can't even think of like in the karate world, just, you know, kind of different, but it's definitely that, like, it's, there's in no way is it like a common thing that like the top guys in the karate world also are, have a reputation for being the best teachers. That's by no means the two things go hand in hand.
Yeah, I mean, I think in jiu-jitsu it varies. So for every John Donaher, who is he teaches at Henzo Gracie's Academy in New York City, one of the top schools in the world for jiu-jitsu, not only competitively, but volume of students and just like everything about it is considered one of the top schools.
Yeah.
He's pretty much considered the top instructor. Mm-hmm. Even probably to a certain extent, more so than Henzo Gracie at this point. Mm-hmm. And some of that just is based off my understanding is that Henzo Gracie is kind of not teaching as much as he used to just because he has that ability. He put in all those years of work in order to allow himself to teach a little bit less.
Yeah.
But John Donaher had a bunch of health issues involving his knee and hips. He's had his hips replaced. He's had his knees replaced. And got into jiu-jitsu a little bit at what would be considered an older age for a competitor to get into it. But he's considered one of the top coaches for not only MMA. He's George St. Pierre's coach. He also is a longtime training partner of Matt Serra. Chris Weidman was one of his students. And those are the three that jump to mind right now when I'm thinking. But there's other people that have come from Henzo Gracie's academy that are high level MMA fighters. But those three stand out because they're three world champions at different points.
Gotcha.
In their MMA career, and then he has Gordon Ryan, who is the best no gi grappler in the world, as one of his students, and he has other students that have accomplished high level things. Gary Tonin, Eddie Cummings, Nicky Ryan. Some of you might not know those names. Again, they're easy to find out who these people are. Just a quick Google search. But again, he is widely considered one of the most brilliant minds in jiu-jitsu and MMA, and he's a guy who's never, ever competed himself. So for every situation like that, you have a situation which I think is a little bit more of a common situation, which is that you have an Andre Galval sort of thing. And Andre Galval runs Atos, which is one of the top competitive jiu-jitsu schools in the world. Based in San Diego, massive student base. Andre Galval is multiple-time world champion in IBJJF. He's won a bunch of ADCCs. He fought at MMA. I think he had like an 8-3 record in Strikeforce. Absolute monster. He's got a bunch of the top guys coming to him, and as a result of that, his school is successful from a competitive standpoint, but he also has a bunch of just casual students that come there as well. I've never taken anything with Andre Galval, so I don't know the quality of his instruction. I've never watched any of his instructionals or anything like that. But again, he is a larger-than-life figure. And jiu-jitsu is so, I guess, the sparring part is such a huge part of jiu-jitsu that it's a little bit more common that people are seeking instructors that are super, super tough, dominating, one of bunch of things, and have all these accolades. Mm-hmm. So the John Donahares are a little less, and you find a little bit more of the Andre Galvals. Now, maybe not those same accomplishments, but usually they have some high-level championship that they've won at some level that they're kind of staking the reputation on. Sure. Even if it's a world championship as a blue belt, they'll still say, I was a world champion.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think that there's just a lot of things that, you know, you can abuse your own reputation with it a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I think that's the point that you can kind of like, you might be the, you know, you might have been a very, very high level competitor in whatever, you know, martial art that you're practicing. And so therefore, to people that are, you know, looking to get into it that don't know any better, the assumption is just that, oh, you know, like, that's the guy to train with because he's the best. So therefore, he's going to be able to make me really good too. It's like those two things don't always go hand in hand. And, you know, I definitely, I'm not going to name any individuals here, but I can think of people in the karate world who have reputation for, you know, this is another thing that's come up before in previous episodes of this podcast, like the concept of poaching students.
Yeah.
And it's a big thing that, you know, like there's some high level karate guys who, you know, like world champions, very well known, very, you know, respected in the world, but they have a tendency of just taking other people's students. That they'll get these guys that, you know, already are experienced artists, already trained with someone else, and then they'll just take them, you know, make and put, bring them under their wing, and therefore make a part of what they're doing. But like, they didn't take that guy from day one, you know, and make him into what he is today. They took a guy who was already a well-developed martial artist, and then just start associating with him, start doing that kind of thing. And that's often what they're criticized for, is that it's like, yeah, he may have been great himself, but, you know, like, who are his students? Who are the people that, you know, they took from day one and turned into, you know, great martial artists themselves? It's like, it's not something that, you know, I think it's kind of extraordinary when you find somebody that can do both, you know?
Yeah, so I think that happens when you're describing the student, getting a student after they've already had developed, they're really good, they're winning, and then they get recruited to a bigger team. That happens all the time in jiu-jitsu, competitive jiu-jitsu.
And very different culture in jiu-jitsu is the impression I get from,
I mean, karate. In kind of, right now we're talking about kind of like the top schools.
Yeah.
I think just talking about kind of maybe your average martial arts art school.
Yeah.
Because to a certain extent, there's some people that are seeking out the best guys. But those are usually people with, I feel like, competitive aspirations.
Sure.
If you're just like, hey, this is just like a hobby thing that I like to do for self-defense or for working out or whatever, staying in shape, I think you're a little more likely just to pick a school based off convenience.
Definitely.
So like location, cost, whatever. Even within that context, I still think if we took like a poll of people and I think that whether they know it or not, lots of people seek out somebody who they think can dominate them because we're doing martial arts, and regardless of what anybody wants to say, we are influenced by what we consume. So mm-hmm. what books we read, what movies we watch, what TV shows we watch.
Yeah.
And there is this concept that has been kind of jammed down our throats because of movies and television, that if you are a black belt in a martial art, you're supposed to be this larger-than-life figure
sure.
that can overcome any other person except for another black belt.
Yeah.
In a physical confrontation. Oh,
then it's like a kung fu movie.
It's like people will be like, hey, you're X amount of level and you're 100 and we'll use somebody with around my size or smaller. So let's say you're 140 pounds, 130 pounds. And a 230 pound guy walks in who's super physically gifted and strong.
Yeah.
Well, even if the person who's 140 to 130 pounds succeeds in winning in the sparring situation,
yeah.
it probably took a lot more effort than if we were the same size or sit more closely together in size.
Sure.
So the person starts to go, in their mind, the big guy, well, this stuff works, but it's not as effective as maybe I thought it was.
Sure.
Or maybe there's just such a physical size advantage, they go, oh, this guy, he's supposed to be a brown belt?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just destroyed him in training. So how good is he really? How good is this school really? Because he's one of the instructors. And I just destroyed him.
Sure.
And like the thing is that it's not a movie. It's not a television show. We're human beings. And the belts at the end of the day are great. And it's a recognition of how like much time and effort you put into it. It's kind of an indicator of what we think a skill level is supposed to be, but we're still people.
Sure.
So
yeah.
somebody with physical gifts can sometimes overtake all those skills.
Yep.
Somebody might just get lucky and match up with you on a day where you're having a bad day.
Yeah.
And they're having a good day. You might be sick. You might be injured. And you still train with that person and they beat you that day.
Yeah.
Well, for somebody who I guess is a little less secure in themselves and don't understand sometimes that the ability to win a match is not always indicative of what that person can give you.
Sure.
They're just like, hey, this isn't a place or an environment I want to learn in because these guys aren't monsters that beat me up all the time.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's why in my opinion, you know, common thing that the best teachers I've been exposed to all seem to say is that, you know, like there's no amount of training that makes violence safe. And that's one of the reasons why to stress, you know, for any kind of like self-defense focused practice, or not even necessarily if that's the focus of your practice, even just if you acknowledge, you know, there's some piece of what you do
yeah.
where you acknowledge the realities of self-defense, they always say it's always better not to engage in physical conflict if you have an option not to. It doesn't matter how much training you've had. You can be the best grappler on the planet, right? You can still end up getting your head kicked in by like a group of like 10 guys. You know, those kinds of things happen. So, and there's like kind of a humility that you got to have in order to, you know, in order for that to be the way that you teach your students. Like, hey, you know, jiu-jitsu is great and all. It's a wonderful martial art. I love it. It's very effective. You know, it's something that really gives you a value, like a functional tool set that you can use to defend yourself, but there are some real limitations that you have with it. Always, there's nothing that you can learn. There's no, you know, like, you know, secret, you know, dim mach kung fu technique that's just going to turn you into like some kind of superhero where, you know, you just don't have to worry about the, you know, the risks involved in physical violence at all. That's just not the world that we live in. It's not the way that it works. And I think sometimes when we are talking about those kind of like larger than life, like big, you know, martial arts instructors who are very accomplished themselves and are trying to, like, they really, and maybe I'm not even kind of pointing the finger at anybody say, maybe it's more of a subconscious thing than anything else, but like they kind of buy into that a little bit. You know, you get these people, your students that are kind of worshiping you, and they see you as this, you know, as this person they put up on a pedestal like that. And I think that a lot of good teachers, they do, they're very active and, you know, like kind of challenging that tendency that people have to you know, project onto them this like aura of invincibility or something like that.
Yeah, well, that's why I kind of think you start to see the there's schools where the instructors don't train with their students because they're like, the students might see me as human, and then they might decide that they want to take their business elsewhere.
Sure.
And that's why you start to see, in my opinion, some guys that just are like, I don't train my students. And, or like you see them train very rarely, and then it starts to become this sort of toxic sort of thing where they eventually start to never train because they're afraid that they're going to be maybe like seen as not this invincible figure in front of their students, and then their skills start to erode because they're not keeping their sword sharp. Again, and I think big picture, people have to decide what school is the best environment for them to grow in. I think that there has to be somewhat of a balance of both, but you need to also factor things in mind. Like, so, you know, like you go somewhere and you're like, I've learned in this environment, but it seems like I overtook a bunch of these guys really quick that are the instructors. I'm beating them up. Well, what are some of the factors maybe that's leading me to winning and training?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I've got an 80-pound weight advantage over this person.
Yeah.
But if we were the same size, they have so much technical skill, maybe they'd beat me. Mm-hmm. So that should say right there, hey, this is still somebody who I can get value from.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's just that they're still offering sound advice, and they're like, hey, you're beating me in training right now, but I'm telling you, these things that I'm seeing you do against other people, if you fix these things and work on these things, you're going to see results here. And then you see the results.
Sure.
Like the knowledge might still be there. Maybe there's just something that makes it so they can't.
Yeah. Hey man, I listen to
win in training against you for whatever reason.
I can tell you from personal experience that, you know, I haven't been a teacher that long, so I haven't really run into this issue, I guess, to like its kind of its fullest conclusion. But I've had some students in my school that are like just extraordinarily gifted in terms of just innate athleticism, where they're just like, and I can see the potential in them. Like, yeah, if you stuck with this for 10 years, like you could be like one of the best in the world, like, you know, terms of strength. Like, you have that kind of just natural ability, like the kinds of things that like 99% of students will struggle with for years is like, well, you can just do that. It's like,
yeah.
That's extraordinary. And I can definitely see how, like, and I haven't, you know, really had any students that were that with that kind of talent that have stayed with me for that long. But I can certainly see how I've been doing martial arts for 20 years now. You know, I can see how you get somebody like that stays in your school for like 5 years and they're already, you know, beating you and stuff like that. And that's just the reality. It doesn't mean that like the 20 years of experience that I have, and at this point, the 10 years of teaching experience specifically that I have isn't valuable. But it just means that, you know, if you're talking about combat by itself, you know, that we can kind of almost, you know, we're kind of separate that from the art, from martial arts a little bit separately. The combat is its own thing.
Yeah.
You know, and there's even an arrogance that sometimes martial artists have where you assume that because you're a martial artist, you're automatically like, you know, that there are no non-martial artists out there that could possibly, you know, physically overcome you. And that also is just total BS.
Yeah, yeah.
When the reality is that it's like martial arts, I mean, they definitely, for most people, I think it's helped. It's good to have some kind of skill set that you develop. But talk about just certain, you know, people with just, you know, like the genetic lottery of it, that you're a guy who is, you know, 6 feet tall and like, you know, like 250 pounds when like you're like shredded, you're like in like really good shape. I mean, for a guy like me who's 170 pounds and 5'9", it's kind of like, I think that with the about the like the kind of striking ability that I've developed over years, I mean, would I have like a fighting chance against someone like that? Absolutely. However, yeah. You know, it's like you just can't. There's only so much that you can do to address that size difference people have with people.
And again, like I think big picture, again, it comes down to what you're training for, because like technically from a self-defense or fight perspective, if you come out of a physical confrontation unharmed and safe, you've won.
Sure.
And if you go into a fight being like, my goal is to leave safely as quickly as possible, well, then that could be, this guy is 220 pounds, he's really fit, and he starts a fight with me, and I blasted him with a leg kick, and the leg kick made it hard for him to chase after me when I run away.
Absolutely, yeah.
But when you start talking about a competitive sport of MMA or points karate, judo tournament, wrestling tournament, jiu-jitsu match, well, then there's a very defined rule set that says what victory is and victory is not.
Sure.
And the thing is that I think what people don't think of sometimes in training is, so if you have a physical advantage, whatever it is, it could be that you and your instructor are the same size, but your instructor is in his 60s and you're 20.
Yeah.
So there's a 40-year age gap.
Yep.
Well, that 40-year age gap, you need to ask yourself, okay, what are the chances that even though we're the same size, that I'm going to enter a competitive tournament or an MMA fight, I'm going to be matched up with a 60-year-old person when I'm 20 years old.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's pretty much borderline impossible. What are the chances that I get into a physical confrontation with a 60-year-old man who's the same size as me versus a 24-year-old man who's the same size as me? Well, it's pretty slim that I'm going to get into a physical confrontation with a 60-year-old man who's the same size as me. So when you start to break it down, well, then it's like, okay, so how should I approach training with this person that I'm 40 years younger than? Mm-hmm. And if you come in with a mindset of, okay, I'm going to train with this person for growth.
Sure.
Then you start to very much cater your training to growth and development. So it could be that you handicap yourself in some way. You go, okay,
yeah,
I know that I have better endurance than this 60-year-old person that I'm training with.
Yeah.
So I need to make sure that at the end of our match here in training today, I am less exhausted than them.
Mm-hmm.
Or that if I start amping it up and try to take advantage of the fact that I know, hey, if I go really hard, I'm going to exhaust them before me. I can't do that.
Yeah.
You have to handicap yourself. And then again, you have to also think, how much more knowledge does this person have? Because if they've, it's one thing if they're 60 years old and maybe you've trained the same period of time, but if they're 60 years old and they've been training for, let's say 40 years,
mm-hmm.
50 years. So they're 60, maybe they started training at 10. They have 50 years of experience. There's tons of things that they've seen and done. And maybe you get them today, but maybe the next time they get you and you're like, what's that trick? Oh, I usually don't pull that out.
Yeah.
It's like something I pull out every once in a while because it's kind of like something I have in my back pocket. If I'm ever in an emergency situation and somebody your size were to attack me in the streets, I have this little cool sweep I do to go from the bottom to top and then I could run away.
Yeah.
What's that like you kind of disengaged with me and got an angle that I'm not used to and then you did the leg kick from there. Why did you do that? Oh yeah, that's something that I worked on from time to time. But I only do it in these situations where it's like, I know I'm in a situation where I maybe still have to stay engaged with this guy.
Yeah.
So I'm going to attack the leg like this because I've found tons of success with it. So I only use it in that situation where if I was going to flee, maybe I attack the leg in this way.
Mm-hmm.
That person still has all that experience of all that knowledge.
Sure.
You know, I had this conversation with a couple people the other day, which I think big picture is one of the biggest problems that happens for people in live training, sparring, which is that they aren't present when they train.
Mm-hmm.
They get so focused on winning and losing that they start to be like, in training, I want to win at all costs. I'm not even going to think about what I'm doing. I'm going to go as hard as I can for as long as I can to win in training. Instead of being like, hey, let me take a step back, make sure that I'm present in what I'm doing. So if I lose, at least I know exactly what they did to me.
Yeah.
And if I win, I know all the steps I took to get to that point.
Yeah. Well, I think what you're kind of touching on here is that we need to introduce some kind of rules into our sparring and training, right? And when we do, it becomes kind of artificial in some sense. And that's like, well, like, because then you're like, what are you really training for? Are you training for self-defense? Well, then you got to take into account fighting for escape.
Yeah.
Because,
you know,
like, that's really what self-defense is.
Yeah.
And it's like, but I think that everybody has a tendency to ignore that, to kind of pretend that there isn't this artificial element to your sparring. That like, no, this is real like that, because it, you know, not that there's any, because it means a lot to you, because you want to excel at it and you want to get better at it. But I think that a lot of the time people aren't quite clear about like what they're really going for in their training. Is like, do you just really want to get good at this sport, get good at this sparring, or is the sparring have a purpose where it's, you know, it's trying to develop, and if it's just training, then you should use it as training. So use the example of, you know, like a 20-year-old guy going against a 60-year-old guy and being like, well, I could probably win if I just use athleticism. If I just know that if I just go hard and keep going, I will exhaust him, and then I'll be able to overpower him, even though his technique is way better than mine. You know, I'll just be able to win with sheer strength. It's kind of like, yeah, you can do that, but what do you get out of it?
Exactly. Yeah.
Nothing. You know, it's like that. Instead, to be like, okay, I'm going to like kind of, you know, approach this match like on his terms, which is I'm not going to try to just overpower him. I'm going to try to, you know, meet him technically. You know, I'm going to try and... And I think that if you're willing to take that approach to it, you'll get a lot more out of that sparring. Now, the question might be, though, for the 60-year-old man, though, what's good for his training, though? You know, maybe sometimes, you know, it's like thing for him to think about is that, like, well, what I should prepare for is like a younger, stronger person just trying to overpower me.
Yeah.
Well, and like being able to survive it. But just to take it from the 20-year-old's perspective, I absolutely agree that it's like that's not the best use of your training isn't win at all costs. That's pretty much... It's usually not going to be the best approach to take in anything.
Yeah, right now we're just talking about like a generalized 60-year-old, kind of 20-year-old.
Yeah.
But if the 60-year-old's an instructor, well, then his primary goal is to make sure students are good anyway.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So like again, and this is the kind of the big picture, I guess, to kind of start to lead into the end of this conversation, which is that personally, I think that it's great if your instructor can kind of beat you up. There's something to be said for that.
Sure.
But the number one thing that I personally think is valuable in instructors, are they helping you improve? Mm-hmm. Is their primary concern, I want to make the students at my school great.
Yeah.
I want each individual person in the school to be great.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care about my status as far as like they all think I'm a monster as long as they think I'm great.
Mm-hmm.
Or not I'm great, sorry.
Yeah.
They think they are great.
Sure.
Yeah. Like, and they feel like they are improving and getting better. Like a great instructor's focus is making his students great.
Mm-hmm.
And is willing to do whatever it takes to make their students great. And yeah, I'm sure that there's something to be said about them wanting to continue to be great themselves. But you have to want to give back. That's what great teachers do. They give back to other people. They give more of themselves to other people than they keep for themselves.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%.
And it's something to keep in mind, you know, if you're in a position right now as a listener of like, hey, maybe I'm not training right now, but I got to start looking for a new school. Maybe I'm moving. I need to look for a new school. Maybe I'm not in an environment that I feel like I'm developing and growing. I need to start looking for another school. Again, for some of you, maybe that new environment is, hey, I just want to go somewhere where somebody destroys me and beats me up and I feel helpless.
Yeah.
But I think most people, they want to go to a place where they feel like they're improving and getting better.
Sure.
So go to schools and try things and at different places and see who you think is willing to invest the most in you and you see that they're willing to invest the most in their students.
Sure.
And they kind of put their students above everything else in a training session.
Yeah. No, I mean, I come from a striking perspective here, so a little bit different. I'd love to hear what you would say with the grappling. But, you know, I spar with my students. Like every student in my school has sparred with me. Do something I do with them often like that. And it's always that, like, you know, I just fight down to their level. You know, it's like you try to make it hard for them. Like, they got to really struggle and work hard to get for you. But I'm never trying to overwhelm them. And, you know, it's one of those, I teach mostly young people, like, especially sometimes, like, the young teenagers and stuff. I even encourage them. I tell them to hit me full contact because, you know, like they're young enough and their bodies aren't developed to the point that they're not like not really too much risk of them injuring me.
Yeah.
And, but it also gives them a chance to kind of, you know, go all out with it a little bit. But, it's an interesting thing because I find that I have to constantly check myself though when I'm training with my students to be like that, you know, like you're suppressing that competitive urge that I'd say most martial artists have. And I certainly do. I did competitive, you know, karate for a long time, and that it's like, that's just not something that like I ever want to do with my students. That's not for when I'm training with my students.
Yeah.
I have no desire to be competitive with my students. When I'm training with them, you know, I'm just trying to be the best training partner that I can for them. You know, that, and you really got to sacrifice it because then you're not being the best. It's not the best for you. You know, it's like, it's not like, and so like, I mostly spar with my students now. So it's like, and it's better than nothing because it's still alive. You know, I'm still moving around. I still got to time things the right way. And, you know, there's still, it's not, you know, predictive. I'm sorry, it's not very, very predictable like a lot of other, you know, kinds of partner training like that. But I've never really had the opportunity to like push myself in that kind of situation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this is a whole nother episode and topic to get into, but I think that lots of people don't realize how often some of your instructors and teachers are probably sacrificing time on their own development.
Oh yeah.
For the betterment of their students.
Sure.
They might be like, hey, I see there's a glaring weakness in this position for all my students. I'm not like, I guess I'm not talking about me personally, obviously. Sure. Maybe the instructor's like, I'm not a big fan of this position, period. But I see it as a hole for everybody, so now I have to spend a lot of time gaining knowledge on this so I can give it back to my students because we're getting exploited from this position.
Yeah.
And it's like, or maybe they're like, hey, I never used this thing, but I think it'll work really well for you. Again, that's investing time in something that isn't for them. It's for their students. And I think that happens a lot, especially for the really good instructors. They're investing a ton of time and working on techniques that they may never use because they think that their students need that knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, and that's just perfect. Like, I think maybe it's specific for teachers that train with their students. I do. I train with my students a lot. But, yeah, it's not, you know, what I feel like working on tonight or what I'm trying to develop myself. You know, it's what they need. And that's definitely, I mean, it's something I think about it. I think you have to be conscious of. You have to be careful that you're not kind of like being dominant in the way that you're approaching like group training as when you're the instructor like that. Like you're doing a lot of stuff that it's like it's geared towards you. It's what you want to do, what you want to develop, what's interesting and engaging to you right now in your training is what you're doing with your general class. That's, of course, not, you know, it's not a good way to teach.
Yeah, so I guess to wrap it up right now, I do think that there needs to be somewhat of a balance. Because, again, it's great if somebody has a ton of knowledge, but if they have no evidence ever being able to apply that knowledge, there's something to be said against maybe that being the best learning environment. On the flip side, somebody who's maybe has a laundry list of accomplishments and they can dominate everyone, maybe they aren't great at giving back to their students.
Yeah. And they've managed to be somewhat, you know, successful as teachers. Exactly. Just on reputation without, you know, really... But
I guess big picture, I would say the most important thing in my opinion is that idea of what can your instructor do for you.
Sure.
I think that's more important than what they can do to you. Agreed. Because if they can beat me up, but they can't get me better, then why do I care that they can beat me up?
Yeah. They're a good training partner, but not a teacher.
Exactly. And I think that's something to keep in mind, you know, for everybody who's listening is at the end of the day, the number one thing you should be focused on as a student is, am I learning in this environment? Is it a positive environment for me and maybe your family? Am I enjoying my training? Because, you know, if those three things are no's, or two of them are no's, or even maybe one of them is a no, maybe it's time to start considering going somewhere else.
Sure.
And maybe you might experiment going somewhere else. You might find out that, hey, where I'm at is actually better than I thought.
Yeah.
But again, if it's not an environment where you feel like you're improving, you don't feel safe, you don't feel like you're having a good time, it's time to consider going somewhere else, in my opinion.
Sure. All right. Well, till next time.
Yeah, thanks for listening as always, guys.
Keep training.